Number one, I don't know what to say, so I'm not gonna. Number two, there is some tax policy to talk about. And number three, we end today with superheroes. And we didn't even plan it that way. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday today, the 2nd of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. As the police and the FBI in Las Vegas try to figure out the whys of last night, not that there can ever really be an answer to that question, we are going to stay in our lane and note here only that President Trump said this morning he will make a trip to Las Vegas on Wednesday. Tomorrow, the president is due in Puerto Rico, bringing with him news of a $13 billion request to Congress for emergency assistance. Yesterday, FEMA Director Brock Long pointedly defended the federal response to Hurricane Maria amid mounting criticism. Brock also said Washington is trying to get the private sector more involved in recovery. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that slice of the story.
One big role corporations play in disaster relief, getting stores back open and shelves stocked.
Bottled water, baby formula, diapers, those kind of items, they're just absolutely critical after a crisis.
That's Lucas McDonald, Director of Emergency Operations at Walmart. That company won widespread praise for its response to Hurricane Katrina when it trucked in cases of bottled water, generators, and Pop-Tarts. He says about three-quarters of the company's Puerto Rico facilities are open, but getting fuel to power the generators and moving merchandise has been a challenge.
It's much more difficult in Puerto Rico than it would be in places like Texas or Florida after Harvey and Irma, because we can't drive a truckload of water from someplace like Montana down to Texas.
Corporations also donate money for disaster relief. According to the Foundation Center, giving has topped $300 million for Hurricanes Harvey and Irma. For Maria, just under $40 million so far. Bob Ottenhoff is president of the Center for Disaster Philanthropy.
The population's a lot less, and so are the connections that corporations and foundations have to those areas that have been affected.
Media coverage may also play a role, says Ryan Scott with CauseCast, which helps corporations run employee giving programs.
And I think, you know, our president's response to Puerto Rico has probably turned, you know, off his followers to supporting Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico will likely get a boost in headlines when President Trump visits tomorrow. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There is a conundrum at the heart of the tax plan that Republicans in Congress and the White House are starting their push on. Kind of goes like this. On the one hand, the GOP says the economy is lousy and really, really needs the economic boost that tax cuts would bring. On the other, Janet Yellen and the gang at the Fed say the economy's doing okay. It's not great, but it's okay. And oh yeah, they're raising interest rates to keep things under control. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains that disconnect.
For a while now, the Fed's message has been the economy's doing pretty well, and it's time to phase out the extraordinary support that it put in place during the financial crisis, like ultra-low interest rates. As the unemployment rate has dropped, it's started to worry prices will rise. Here's a little monetary policy refresher, courtesy of Eric Leeper, professor at Indiana University.
As the Fed tries to fight inflation by raising interest rates, the goal there is to make it more costly for people to borrow and therefore try to reduce their spending.
But now enter the GOP and its tax plan, which looks like it may bring some hefty tax cuts, though TBD on the details.
The tax cut, assuming that people spend some of that tax cut, is going to translate into higher demand.
Increased spending on goods and services, that may push prices up, a.k.a. inflation.
Which is precisely what the Fed is trying to avoid. And so you have one policy authority trying to discourage spending and another policy authority trying to encourage spending.
Sort of a tug of war between the Fed and Congress.
So you mean our monetary policy and fiscal policy working at cross purposes here?
Yeah, that's another way to put it, from Michelle Girard, chief U.S. economist at NatWest Markets. And she thinks, no.
It's sort of a handing off of the baton. We have for so long been forced to really rely on almost singly monetary policy to help give the economy a boost. And now the Fed can begin to scale back what it's done, and fiscal policy can pick up more of the slack.
But is there still slack to pick up? Does the U.S. economy still need this kind of support? Carl Tannenbaum, chief economist with Northern Trust.
The timing is somewhat questionable. The United States economy has expanded for 8.5 years. The unemployment rate is at a very low level. That does not paint a picture of an economy that's in need of extensive stimulus.
He says 5 years ago, sure. Now, not so much. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Regulation in the absence of legislation is the main way the Trump administration is changing this economy. And the power outages in Puerto Rico are concentrating the mind on regulation of the power industry. The White House is calling for new regulations to reward what it considers key sources of always-on electricity, coal and nuclear power specifically. Or if you put it another way, help for power plants that can't really compete in today's economy. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Here's the administration's argument. To avoid blackouts, you need power plants with fuel on site. For instance, uranium for nuclear or piles of coal for coal plants. And they should get paid extra to ensure that reliability. Adam Cohen is former Deputy Undersecretary of Energy.
The idea of having their coal pile on site could be viewed as more reliable because there is no need for transportation, say, over the road.
Fair enough. But coal piles have frozen during bad winters, and they got soaked in Hurricane Harvey.
We certainly did learn from Texas that coal, when it's outside, gets wet and may not be as reliable.
What critics think is really going on is coal and nuclear energy are getting outcompeted by cheaper natural gas, and in some places by wind and solar. So they want subsidies, bailout, finger on the scale. Electricity analyst Sam Newell at the Brattle Group says any change could disrupt energy markets because they're really complicated.
They reflect a balance of views and careful deliberation. And a proposal like this could abruptly and profoundly change those markets and upset the balance that we have.
How? Well, the details have a long way to go. But if regulators force buyers to pay a premium for presumed reliability and resiliency, that means higher rates. Christy Tizak is director at Clearview Energy Partners.
What it certainly seems to do is create some sort of floor price, which may raise prices for consumers. And I think we're going to see a very robust discussion.
That's a nice DC way of saying big energy fight coming to the cafeteria. The administration wants to pull this off in 2 months, but analysts are dubious. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, more records, but it does kind of seem beside the point, huh? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The corporate story of this Monday has a dose of inside baseball, a smidge of corporate governance, a bit of board of directors politics, and a whole lot of, wait, he did what? Uber is whereof we speak. Travis Kalanick may be out as the CEO of, it has to be mentioned, the company he co-founded. But he is clearly far from done disrupting things, and I'm not talking about the ride-sharing business here. Over the weekend, Kalanick named 2 new members to that company's board of directors, pretty much without consulting anybody, including Uber's brand-new CEO, Dara Khosrowshahi. What to do about a founder who won't take the hint is not a new dilemma, but there are lessons here for tech in the 21st century. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has them.
People like to throw this term around a lot, but John Coffey says what's happening with Uber's board of directors is almost Shakespearean. Coffey is a corporate governance expert at Columbia University Law School.
There have been lots of closely held companies that are not yet public, in which you have the Capulets on one side and the Montagues on the other, and there is a civil war going on.
But rarely are these companies as big as Uber, which is valued at roughly $70 billion. And rarely do they have so much at stake, heavyweight investors with a lot to lose and a likely IPO. Charles Elson at the University of Delaware says this kind of infighting can be costly.
It just means it's very hard to run a business where you have that kind of contentiousness. Businesses really need to move forward with near unanimity.
And Elson says the way many tech companies are set up could be making things harder. Enter the dual class stock structure, where some shares come with more voting power than others. And they're often in the hands of the founders, like at Uber and Facebook.
When you have a dual class share structure, you're giving frequently one person or a very small number of people control over everything that happens with that company.
Michelle Lowry is a professor of finance at Drexel University.
And if you're an investor in that company, you effectively have very little say over what happens.
Like whether you get a heads up when new board members get appointed. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The vote in the Spanish region of Catalonia this weekend was pretty clear. 90% of the nearly 2.5 million ballots cast were in favor of independence. Not at all clear, though, is what happens next. The central government in Madrid is opposed, violently so, to Catalonian independence, a position that seems to be as much economic as it is constitutional. We got our European Bureau Chief Stephen Beard on the line to get a little context here. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
Give me the, the economic once-over on Catalonia, would you?
Well, this is an integral part of Spain, which we should remind ourselves is the 14th largest economy in the world and the fourth largest in the EU after Britain leaves. It is one of the richest regions in Spain. It's a big net contributor to the central government's budget. It accounts for almost 20% of the Spanish economy. It has the country's business capital within its territory, mm-hmm. Barcelona. The whole country of Spain would struggle to hold itself together if Catalonia separated.
So we know then why the Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy was so intent on keeping it. What inside Catalonia drives the independence movement then?
There's a very strong cultural element here, and there has been for years. I mean, Catalans have their own language, their own culture, but in recent years, economics is undoubtedly a very important driver of this move. Many Catalans blame the central government in Madrid for exposing the country to the 2008 financial crisis, for not restraining the real estate boom that preceded it, even though they make a big net contribution to the central government's budget, they feel that they suffered disproportionately in the austerity in the public spending cuts that followed.
Right. Can't help but notice that the euro is down here this morning against the dollar. Take a step back for me, would you, and give me the European Union-wide picture on this thing?
This is a horrible and difficult issue for the EU. I mean, various EU leaders have come out today and condemned the police violence and brutality. But the general reaction has been this is an internal matter for Spain. We don't want to get involved. The EU hates this, of course. Mm. Separation and secession within a member state is very bad news for a bloc that is striving to hold itself together and is currently doing its utmost to punish Britain for daring to break away from the EU. But I mean, at a practical level, there are a number of different regions across Europe, yeah. in Italy, in Belgium, that might, if Catalonia separated, be tempted to try the same thing.
Never a dull moment in the European Union. Quickly, Stephen, what's next? Where do we go from here?
Well, the Catalan leader says he's going to put the referendum result to the Catalan parliament and let it decide what happens next. It's difficult to say what is going to happen next in this very volatile and febrile atmosphere. But the Catalan parliament, some suggest, will call for independence, will declare independence later this week. However, we should say, according to the last opinion poll on this subject, most Catalans, by a margin of about 8 or 9%, yeah. were actually against independence. So who knows? I mean, it's a very – given the bloodletting on Sunday, maybe that will sway more people into the independence camp.
There is a general strike called for tomorrow, right, in Catalonia?
There is, yes. Yeah. I mean, more than 40 labor unions have called for a region-wide general strike. So whatever happens, Catalonia – and Spain are in for a period of considerable turmoil.
Stephen Beard in London for us. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up.
Somebody told me, one of the writers, that when he walked in there in the 60s, the only thing in there was Stan Lee and a $10 couch.
Yeah, the couches at Marvel Comics are probably a bit more expensive these days, huh? First, though, sure, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 152 today, 0.6%, 22,557 on the blue chips. NASDAQ up 20 points, 0.3%, finished at 65.16. The S&P 500 jumped 9.3%, 25.29. The former CEO of Equifax, Richard Smith, testifies on Capitol Hill this week about that big data breach that cost him his job. Equifax up 1.7% today. The other big credit agencies, TransUnion, up 0.5%. Experian, traded in London, lifted about 0.5%. The family that owns Nordstrom department store said in June it might sell off its stake. The buyer has been tough to nail down. Nordstrom stock off 6.2% today. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.34%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. One of the things that Republicans say is driving their push to overhaul the tax code, apart from hoping that tax cuts are going to boost the economy, is simplification, making it easier for people to calculate their taxes, understand those calculations, and then filing and paying the taxes. To be sure, the Internal Revenue Code is unwieldy, but tax simplification doesn't mean just clearing up language that was overwritten or cutting loopholes that were added in different economic times. I mean, it is some of that, but tax simplification is, at its heart, about rethinking the way the government wants us to behave. Marketplace's Adrian Hill explains.
We ask our tax code to do a whole lot more than just raise money for the government.
We ask our tax code to be an anti-poverty program.
Daniel Himmel is a law professor at the University of Chicago.
We ask our tax code to be a housing program. We ask our tax code to be a primary way of funding health care in the country.
We ask our tax code to nudge us to be better people, to give more to charity, save more for retirement, spend more on education.
We ask pretty much everything from our tax code.
No wonder our taxes are complicated. If you stop and think about it, these tax credits, deductions, tax preferences,
what they represent is spending. It's actually disguised spending.
Adam Chodorow is a professor at Arizona State University's law school. Spending, he says, because tax breaks cost the government money. Deductions for me or you or Warren Buffett or Amazon, they're a revenue loser for the feds.
In the tax business, we refer to them actually as tax expenditures.
And those tax expenditures add up. There's currently about $1.5 trillion of federal spending through the tax code. So why? Why do politicians on both sides push social policy and behavior through taxes instead of just running those programs through the budget? Well, for one, it sounds better.
So let's say we want to encourage people to buy energy-efficient cars. Well, we could send them checks, but that's spending money.
Or we could promise them a tax credit, a tax deduction, and voila, like magic, a spending program has been transformed into a tax cut. There's another reason politicians prefer tax code spending over spending through the budget.
It doesn't come up every year for review.
Joseph Hinchman is executive vice president at the Tax Foundation.
Tax credits and tax deductions, once you put them in the tax code, they're automatic, unlike spending, which has to get reviewed periodically.
Out of sight. Out of mind. Pro tip, if you want to keep a social program around for a while, get it in the tax code. Because once it's there, it's really hard to get out. Which is part of the reason meaningful tax simplification is so difficult.
When you start talking about changing these tax expenditures, changing the provisions in the code, then it becomes public again.
Dorothy Brown is a law professor at Emory University. All of a sudden, that tax break you sold before, take it away, and it looks like a tax increase.
Everybody comes out of the woodwork talking about, you know, this is the worst thing possible.
To meaningfully simplify our tax code, like the GOP is promising, it's not about squeezing a filing onto a postcard. It'll take discussing the tax breaks and the values behind them and require a big change to how both parties do business. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
We're going to take a step back from the real world here for a second, mercifully today, one might say, and enter the world of superheroes. Fantasy, yes, but the universes created by DC and Marvel Comics have some tangible effects that run to the billions of dollars. Not the actual comic books, of course, but hoo boy, the movie franchises, huh? Reed Tucker follows the history of the two biggest names in comics, DC and Marvel, in his new book. It's called Slugfest: Inside the Epic 50-Year Battle Between Marvel and DC. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Kai.
You point out in your prologue here that it was not all that long ago that comic books in this economy were about as marginalized and irrelevant as they could be.
It's so true, and that's what I think is just so incredible about what's happening now, where comic books have basically become mainstream pop culture. You know, if you think about them, and even back in the 50s, we were holding Senate hearings, you know, investigating basically the danger of reading comic books. And so they sort of went underground for a while. And in the 70s and 80s, you know, they had comic book stores, but they were often in sort of these grotty strip malls. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were dark, dusty places and not very welcoming. So to see comic books come out into the light, into the mainstream like this, and they're now multi-billion dollar businesses when it comes to TV and movies, to me is kind of astounding.
But also, and you make this point as well in the beginning of the book, 50, 80 years ago, it was DC and Marvel. Today, it's DC and Marvel at the billion-dollar levels.
Exactly. You know, I was trying to think of other businesses that just had two main competitors, and really the only one I could think of off the top of my head was the Cola Wars. You know, Coke and Pepsi, and they've been battling each other for years. But yeah, it's astonishing that no other company has really been able to break in.
They were in the early days anyway. Completely contrasting examples of, I guess, corporate culture, right? DC, you say, was more sort of buttoned down, and then Marvel, once Stan Lee gets in there, is more free-flowing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. People think of comic book industry as being this fun, kind of jokey place to be, and there are all these stories of comic book fans visiting DC in the 60s and just being really, really let down when they got into the office because it looked like, you know, they were selling insurance in there. People wearing suits, you know, there's kind of a hushed tone. It felt very conservative. Meanwhile, Marvel, in part because they didn't have as much success as DC had early on and they didn't have as much money, their offices were much more DIY. Somebody told me, one of the writers, that when he walked in there in the 60s, the only thing in there was Stan Lee and a $10 couch. So in part, that has directed the culture at both the companies.
Right. Am I being a false romantic if I lament the demise of the actual comic book in favor of what has become much more mass entertainment with these movies? Or is that just the way the business has to be, man?
You know, they have almost gone away many times over the years, even as far back as the 70s. You know, when Warner Communications first started taking over DC, those executives would come in, they would look at the ledgers of the comic book publishing business, and they would say, why are we still publishing comic books? And the publisher would say, well, we're doing it because it's almost like a laboratory where we try out new ideas, we create new characters, and down the line, those characters are going to be very valuable.
Do you think, even though, as we've been talking about, they have become these cultural behemoths, that DC and Marvel are going to be around for a while in the comic book publishing business as opposed to the intellectual property business?
It's a good question. You know, I asked a lot of people who work in the business, and they could all envision a day where there is no more comic book publishing.
Wow.
That these characters are just, you know, sort of IP libraries that are mined for TV and movie projects going forward. I guess in our favor, if you want to see comic books stay around, what I've been told is one of the reasons that they keep publishing them is to keep the trademarks alive for some of these more obscure characters. So I don't think it's going to go away, but it just depends on who's in charge and who's looking at the numbers, I suppose.
Do you have a favorite character in comic books?
Well, I always liked Batman growing up. Part of that was because, you know, he's cool and he was kind of darker than some of the other DC heroes, you know, that I owned underoos of, like Superman or Wonder Woman. But
Wait, you had Wonder Woman underoos? Cut it out.
I think it was given to me by Santa Claus one year, but I didn't ask too many questions.
Reed Tucker's new book about DC and Marvel is called Slugfest. Reed, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
This final note on the way out today, in which I repeat myself, and sadly not for the first time. After the shootings in Newtown 5 years ago, in which 20 children and 6 adults were killed, and Orlando last summer when 49 people were killed, I pointed out that there are more retail shops in this country where you can buy a gun than there are Starbucks on the entire planet. It was true then, both times, still true today. Okay, we got to go. The Dow was up today. The NASDAQ was up today. S&P 500 up today as well. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.